Well, thank you, Laura. Appreciate that very much. That think about the words of that song. It certainly does help us, should help us get our mind where it needs to be and thinking about this type of this time of year. I did want to also make mention that I don't have all the information written down, but I want to give Megan Chapman congratulations. If you haven't heard, she has they had a bouncing baby boy. Name's Axel Eugene. That's about all I know. So congratulations to her. And so we'll look forward to seeing them with us soon. You know, there's a question that's asked a lot, and we run through this through different periods of life. You know, things happen to us, or we come across different seasons of life. And this happens to be one of those seasons that we're in with the Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread and the Holy Days coming up, that we might ask the question to ourselves, well, if I only had one day left to live, what would I do? You know, I titled this message, 24 Hours to Live. 24 Hours to Live. And I wasn't really aware of all this, because I've had that question asked me before, and I've thought about it before, and I've never really given a lot of thought as to what my answer might be. And but there's been many, many surveys done on that question. If you had one day, 24 hours to live, what would you do? So I'm going to give you the percentages. Now, I don't know how many thousands of people this involved, but it involved several thousand people. But let me give you the breakdown of percentages of what their answers were. They might surprise you and they might not. So the first breakdown is 75% of this group said that they would deal with family and friends. They would give more hugs. They would have more meaningful conversations. And they would do just normal things with their family and friends. 75% of the people answered it that way. Then it goes all down to 10%. 10% of that same group answered that they would go to the beach, go to the forests, go see a sunset, see some of God's creation, something they may be taking for granted. Well, that makes sense too. 8% said they would write their wills. Well, it's not a bad thing. Maybe we should do that before the last day. But they would write their wills. They would write general letters of apology. So you see that 8%, like they're really starting to think. 5% said they would have their favorite meal. That's what they would do. 5% say they would have a favorite meal. They would have their last hurrah, whatever that might be. And then 2% of that thousands of group said they would go into hiding. They would go into crying. They would live reckless behavior. That's interesting. When you think about all of that, that's really interesting. What people would do with the last day of their life. You know, this is what you have. If God said, listen, tomorrow at 1:40, you're going to die. What are you going to do? Well, this is what thousands of people said they would do. What would you do? I want you to think about this question. What would you do if today was your last day? If you knew you only had 24 hours left? Our brother, Jesus Christ, among other things, he washed feet. Let that sink in for just a minute. There's a profound contrast between Jesus Christ and the world, without a doubt. His last day was absolutely not focused on what he could get out of life, but instead it was focused on how he could serve in his last day. And we know he came to the earth in the physical form as a ministry, and he did that to supply life to all of us. But when you start seeing his last 3 years, his last 24 hours, it becomes so almost in your face with his service that it's almost unbelievable what he did, knowing all along what he was going through in the physical, in the mental, the stress, what he was going through, but what he did. I'd like to start, if you would, turn with me to John chapter 13. And we'll look at verses 1 through 17. John chapter 13. Starting in verse 1. Now before the feast of Passover, when Jesus knew, that's pretty important, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart from this world to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. Now skip to verse 3. Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hand, and that he had come from God and was going to God. Just in those two verses, we see several things that he knew. Now, he knew a lot. I mean, I'm not taking anything from that. But it points out to us so that we could understand what he knew. He knew that his hour was at hand. He knew when he was going to die. He knew the time. He knew that he loved his own, the people that God gave him to bring out of this world. He knew who they were. And then he knew that his love would go until the very end. We see that. He knew where he came from. He knew where he was going. These are all things, brethren, that you and I should come to know in our life. Now, we don't necessarily know the minute, the hour, even the day that we're going to die. But we do know one thing. At the return of Jesus Christ, that's going to be the final death of all of us if we remain faithful. If we live over into it or we die and are resurrected, that change comes. There's a couple of key points here, though. Verse 1 tells us that Jesus knew the hour had come. We talked about that. He lived with this knowledge, and he didn't avoid the reality of that. You know, he didn't try to run and hide. He didn't say, no, well, I don't think I'm going to make the appointment, God. Sorry. He didn't do any of that. He was going to love all his people, all the ones that came to him from God, love them to the very end. In verse 3, we see that he knew that the Father put all things under his power. You know what that means? He was in control. We talked about that last week. He was in control. He was serving from a place of security, if you will. And he knew that he came from God and was returning to God. You know, all of us have that same knowledge and ability if we will rely on it. It's faith. When we realize this, then, brethren, we are able to serve others, serve each other completely, without hesitation. Let's continue on here, verse 4 through 11. Let me do verse 3, kind of lead into verse 4. It says, Jesus knew, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, and that he had come from God and was going to God, rose, verse 4, rose from supper and laid aside his garments, took a towel and girded himself. After that, he poured water into a basin and began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with the towel with which he was girded. Then he came to Simon Peter, and Peter said to him, Lord, are you washing my feet? Jesus answered and said to him, what I am doing you do not understand now, but you will know after this. Peter said to him, you shall never wash my feet. And Christ answered, if I do not wash your feet, you have no part with me. So, and I think we can get to this. We can understand this. We probably would have said the same thing. You know, in verse 9, Peter says to him, "Lord, not my feet only, but also my hands and my head." You know, the whole thing, you know, "Don't stop at my feet, Father. If I can't be part with you, I want everything." When Peter thought he understood what Christ was doing, then he was all about it. But before he understood what Christ was doing, or thought he did anyway, he wasn't. Even at this point, Peter didn't understand. He kind of jumped. He reacted. Brother, it takes a Christian time to understand these things. Jesus said to him in verse 10, "He who is bathed needs only to wash his feet, but is completely clean, and you are clean." He was saying, you've been baptized, you've remained faithful, you're clean. This is a recommitment. You're clean. Verse 11, "For he knew who would betray him, therefore he said, 'You are not all clean.'" During this time in history, the very act of washing someone's feet, it was at the very least, a very degrading act. It was a degrading act of service. It was what they hired the slaves, the ones who had nothing. They brought them in. They hired them to wash people's feet. When travelers came to your house, they had their servants come and wash the feet. They wasn't going to do it, but the servants could. It was a very degrading act. When Jesus did this, he was going against all worldly, power here, structures. Going against what the world had set up, which that shouldn't surprise us. This is Satan's world. Jesus even washed the traitor's feet, already knowing that Judas had decided to betray him. He knew that. There's a huge lesson here. He knew this. Peter refused, which was a form of pride. The thing is, when we have to understand that Jesus Christ, he came to serve. And you and I have to have the understanding of willing to let Jesus Christ serve. Because if we don't come to that understanding that Jesus can serve us, we will never be able to serve each other or anybody else. Verse 12 through 15 kind of describes a mandate for the churches. "So when he had washed their feet, taken his garment, and sat down again, he said to them, 'Do you know what I have done to you? You call me teacher and Lord, and you say, well, for so I am. If I then, your Lord and teacher, have washed your feet, you also ought to wash one another's feet. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you.'" So here, Christ gave a pattern or an example for every one of us to follow. And of course, this is what we do. At Passover, we do this. He said, "Do as I have done." Do you ever think about that? Do as I have done? In this context of what he just did to all the disciples. He just washed their feet. He took an act that was, from worldly perspective, below any average citizen, let alone higher up citizens. And he did this. And they said, "Do as I have done." Do you know what that was? Well, that was a command to have, for you and I to have, an attitude of humility. Humble. This is to be present in absolutely all of our relationships. Greatness is redefined here as well. To be chief in God's kingdom, then we are to be the servants. If we want to be there, we have to have an attitude, a mind of humility. Because if we don't have a humble heart, I would guarantee you from God's word that we will not be there. So what does this look like every day in our everyday life? Well, how about something as simple as doing someone's dishes that are left? You know, I struggle with this, and I'll tell you why. This is just a little personal here. Up at work, we have a full-blown kitchen. We have microwave, ranges, a couple of refrigerators, a nice sink. We have all the dishes you could want. And it really gets on my nerves when I go in there and see a sink full of dirty dishes. And it happens all the time. So therefore, I used to do them. And then I took the pharisaical stand, saying that they're not my dishes, I'm not doing them. I did that for a while. And then the other day I did them again. But, you know, something I have to overcome. We all have little things we have to overcome. That's why I put this, something as simple as doing dishes. Yeah. Sometimes we don't like doing dishes. You know, we don't mind doing ours, but somebody else's? Why not? It doesn't matter why they left them. Maybe they left them just to get on my nerves. Job well done. Oh. Well, how about listening to a friend? You know, we say, well, I can listen to my friend. Well, you can listen to your friend until your friend starts annoying you. Then are you still going to listen? Well, yeah, we better. Listen to a friend. Well, just do the hidden jobs at the church, you know, without recognition. If you want to know a job, there's a half a dozen of us, here that could give you a job if you want a job. But do it without recognition. You know, the thing is, all these jobs, and these are just three minimal lists, or minimal jobs on this list. There's many, many things that we can do. And are we doing it so somebody can see us? Or are we doing it so God knows our heart? That's what we should be doing it for. If you thought today was your last day, would it be a day of self-indulgence, or would it be a day of self-sacrifice? That's what we need to ask. And the answer to that is, we don't know when our last day is. So, the answer is, every day should be a day of sacrifice. It should be. To a certain point, it should be a day of sacrifice. Let's go ahead and continue on in verse 16. Most assuredly, I say to you, a servant is not greater than his master, nor is he who sent greater than he who sent him. If you know these things, now listen to this, blessed are you if you do them. That's what God says. If you know to do and you don't do, then shame on you. But if you know to do these things, God says, then you are blessed. He will bless you. He'll take care of it. Jesus tells us we'll be blessed if we do these things. And these things are having a humble heart, taking the initiative to serve others. That's what these things are. We need to cultivate a servant's heart. And that's seeking others' needs, whatever they are, little or big, seeking their needs above our own. The example of Christ washing Judas's feet is probably one of the greatest examples of having a servant's heart, and I'd go a little step further and saying it's one of the greatest examples of loving your enemy. If somebody came up to you and you knew their motives and they gave you a kiss and you knew that kiss meant death, would you still love them? Would you still hug them? Would you still wash their feet? Look at Matthew chapter 5. Matthew chapter 5, verse 44. Kind of a strong command for us to take heart with. We need to do it. Matthew 5, verse 44. But I say to you, love your enemies. There's the first part of it. Bless those who curse you. There's another part. That's not all. Do good to those who hate you. Man, and now check this one out. And pray for those who spitefully use you and persecute you. Every bit of this, Judas did to Christ. Christ took this and he made it a reality when he got down on his knees in front of Judas Iscariot and he washed his feet. Foot washing, again, is seen as an act of humility. But Christ takes it to be an example of strength and grace. That's something we can give. Something we can give to others. The betrayal here from Judas to Christ, it was extremely deep. Before the Passover service even began, Satan had already prompted Judas to betray Christ. So it was already set in motion. Judas knew it. Christ knew it. Let me just read to you John 13, verse 2. We skipped that one, but I'll read it to you. And supper being ended, the devil having already put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray Christ. We skipped that because I wanted to touch on it now. But Judas was right there, if you will, in Christ's inner circle. You know, if you've ever seen the movie, oh, that one movie, having a senior moment, I'm a senior, I can do that. I can't remember the... No. This doesn't involve... The movie doesn't involve anything related here, other than the fact, the inner circle, the circle of trust, the ring. Meet the parents. Okay. Well, it's whenever, you know, Jack's father-in-law, you know, is kind of working with him and says, you can be in the circle of trust, but you know, it's going, you've got to prove yourself. Well, Judas was in that circle. He was in the circle, in the inner circle, if you will. He wasn't just a face in the crowd. You know, he wasn't just a trusted companion. He was one of the 12. You know, of all the thousands of people that Christ could have picked, he picked Judas, one of the 12. He had shared many meals with Christ, with the fellow disciples, many, many conversations. And of course, a time of ministry right alongside Jesus Christ. And all of that, I can understand, would made that sting of betrayal much, much sharper than it would have been for somebody off the street, so to speak. Christ knew what was happening. He did not wash Judas's feet out of ignorance. He knew what it was all about. He did it in the midst of the payment of silver that Judas was about to receive and the upcoming kiss that Christ was about to receive. He did it anyway. So, what was his reason for including Judas? A key reason would be that love, godly love, agape love, is not conditional on loyalty. Christ proved here that his love isn't a reward for good behavior. It's actually a gift of grace, and it extended even to an unrepentant person. You kind of think about that. And if you go ahead today, tomorrow, in the future, after the 1,000 years, after the great white throne judgment, and when all the ones will be cast into the lake of fire that will be there, that is still an act of love. It's an act of God's love, all the way to the very end. This was no different. Jesus Christ showed just a little sample of the true love, what that really meant. Possibly, this was an opportunity for Judas to reconsider his heart. I don't know. We know prophecy had to be fulfilled. This example is also what we are told to follow. We just read this in John 13, verse 15. I'll read it to you again. John 13, verse 15. For I have given you an example that you should do as I have done to you. Now, do you think if Christ would have went straight to any of the other 11, say Peter, for example, and Peter acted the way he did, and the rest of them heard it, and he continued on, and then he would have skipped Judas, do you think that would have gave you and I an excuse not to wash somebody's feet that we didn't like? Absolutely it would have. It wouldn't have been justified. This is one of the reasons why he chose Judas. He said, look, I'm doing it. I know what this guy's going to do to me. I know what lies ahead. Godly love prevails. You think about if Jesus would have skipped Judas. If he would have skipped Judas. Again, I think about this a lot, especially this time of year. Would this give you and I an excuse to not love our enemies? Not do good to those who hate us, that persecute us? All that, by including him, brethren, you and I do not have a biblical, spiritual right to withhold service from those who hurt us. That's one of the things we see in this service that Christ did with Judas. There's a difference noted here as well between service and salvation. Jesus said that the disciples were not all clean. That's John 13, verse 11. We read that. This demonstrates that we can serve and love our enemies without, and I want you to understand this, without endorsing their sin, or even guaranteeing their salvation, which you and I can't do anyway. But that's exactly what Christ did with Judas. So we have to remember that. So, what are some modern applications of this example? Well, loving your enemy doesn't mean being a doormat, but it is about not letting their hatred change you and I's character. We need to have the character of God, and we cannot allow others to change that. When we kneel before those who have wronged us, we may not be reconciling, although it'd be good if we could, but we should be releasing any bitterness that we harbor on our part. We can only do what we can do. We're told to, make peace with others as much as possible. That means it's on us. We have to do this. And this is done, it should be done before Passover. Jesus, he defines greatness as how many people we are willing to serve. Not how great we are, but how many people we're willing to serve and who they are. Imagine the scene now, if you will, in the upper room. The disciples here, the story, they're arguing about who's the greatest in the kingdom. When you're sitting there watching this argument go on, you can just about assume that their hearts are full of pride. Judas is there. He's right in the middle of them. His heart is full of something else. And we don't know this at the time, but it's full of silver. It's full of satisfaction that he's going to get from the betrayal that he's about to commit. Jesus Christ is there. His heart is full of love for everyone there and for all of us, the world. When Christ picked up the towel, he did not ask for a background check of any of the disciples. He didn't do it. He didn't ask for an oath of loyalty from any of the disciples. He didn't skip the man who he knew at that point would sell him for a price of silver. Instead, he knelt, he washed, and he dried. And he did it lovingly and faithfully and willingly. I hope that as we think about this, when our time at Passover in just a few days comes, we remember these things. Even if we don't have any harboring any ill feelings with anybody, which I hope we don't. But certainly if we do, I hope we remember these things. If Christ had one day left and spent out washing the feet of the man who would turn to him, give him a kiss to mark his death, what does that say about our holding a grudge? And it could be the smallest grudge. It doesn't matter. What's that say about that? So, I'm going to ask all you guys to close your eyes for a minute. Do not go to sleep. I saw a little meme that said, my boss said I'm a computer. Not for my intelligence, but whenever I'm left alone for 10 minutes, I go to sleep. I'm not going to leave you alone for 10 minutes. But I want you to close your eyes for a minute. I want you to ask yourself, and keep it to yourself, please. Who is the person that you hope God skips? That might shock you, and I hope it does. Who is the person you feel justified in hating? If there's a name that popped into your head, that is your Judas. This week, as you go through the week, don't pray for them to change. Instead, pray that your heart is changed. Ask God for the strength to see them not as the enemy, not as Judas, but as someone who is potentially unclean and needing the same grace that you received. Okay, you can open your eyes. Again, I hope nobody had a name, but if you did, I want you to take that seriously. Take that for heart. We often say that we want to be like Jesus Christ. But on his last day, that meant picking up a towel and not doing miracles. Whose feet are we hesitant about washing? And again, that's between us and God. And it needs to be between us and God. And we need to overcome that. To understand the final 24 hours of Jesus Christ's life, this is to what I would call witness the ultimate symphony of grace and truth. I use that theme for the men's club, and that's the kind of theme we're going through this year of grace and truth. So I'm kind of trying to keep that woven in here. But when you think about that, Christ, he moved through these hours not as a victim of circumstance, which a lot of times that's how we seem, but instead he went through as a master or a commander of a great mission that he accomplished successfully. So as we begin this portion to kind of bring everything together and kind of bring it to a conclusion, I want us to take a look in some detail of the last 24 hours of Christ's life. So let's begin Tuesday evening in the upper room. The time would be between 6 p.m. and 9 p.m. That's when these events took place. Turn to Matthew chapter 26, if you will. Jesus gathered the 12 here in Matthew chapter 26. He takes the traditional Passover elements, unleavened bread and wine, and this is where he redefines them as his own body and blood, and this established the new covenant. Verse 26. And as they were eating, Jesus took bread. He blessed it, and he broke it, and he gave it to the disciples. He said, take, eat, this is my body. And he took the cup and gave thanks, and he gave it to them, saying, drink you all of it, for this is my blood of the New Testament, which is shed for many for the remission of sins. But I say unto you, I will not drink henceforth of this fruit of the vine until that day when I drink it new with you in my Father's kingdom. Now, many of these verses we will read again at Passover, but I want to kind of set the stage again of his last 24 hours and hit some highlights. Next, we'll go to John chapter 13. John chapter 13 here. So in a shocking display of a mind of a servant, Christ, as we've been saying, washed the feet of the disciples. He specifically included Judas, knowing that he had already struck a deal with Satan, with the leadership, to betray Christ. John 13, verse 2, we read this earlier, I'm reading it again. And supper being ended, the devil having now put into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him. So Christ identifies the betrayer. And if you know the story, he did this with a dipped piece of bread. They dipped in sop. Judas leaves into the night. Judas then gives a commandment. But if you remember the story, when he left into the night, the rest of the guys sat around and thought he was going to do something good. They thought he was the treasure. He was going to take care of some needs of the people. Christ knew exactly what he was doing. He told him, "You'll be quick about it." If you're in John 13, go down to verse 34. This is a new commandment. "A new commandment I give to you, that you love one another, as I have loved you, that you also love one another." He gave that commandment, I think in part, to reassure them that they would still love Judas. Knowing what Judas was going to do, they didn't, he did. They would find out, still love him. He promised the Holy Spirit, the Comforter, and he offered the high priestly prayer. And that's found in starting in John chapter 14 all the way through John chapter 17. And this is asking for protection and unity on all the ones and all the believers. Well, the night progresses. Late night, around 10 p.m. to midnight, they move to the Garden of Gethsemane. Jesus entered the garden on the Mount of Olives. While the disciples slept, he experienced this act of sweating blood. His body at this point was under so much mental stress, knowing what was coming, knowing what he had to do, and also knowing that he still had to remain the example. Sometimes we forget that part. Before all the physical beatings and things started, he still knew that he had to remain the example for everybody there and everybody in the future to see. But in doing this, he started sweating blood. Extreme stress caused his capillaries to burst. Look at Luke chapter 24. I'm sorry, Luke 22 and verse 44. Luke 22 and verse 44. "And being in agony, he prayed more earnestly, and his sweat was as it was great drops of blood falling down to the ground." He prays three times here. The final words is that ultimately, "Not my will, Father, but yours be done." Back up to Matthew chapter 26 again. We'll take a quick look at these prayers. Remember, we're between 10 and midnight now. 31 A.D. Matthew 26, verse 39. "And he went a little further, and he fell on his face and prayed, saying, 'O my Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will.' And he came unto the disciples and found them asleep. And he said unto Peter, 'What, could you not watch with me 1 hour? Watch and pray.'" And this is the reason he told him that "you enter not into temptation," because he knew that they were all about to be tried by Satan really hard. that you enter not into temptation. The spirit indeed is willing, but the flesh is weak. Verse 42. He went away again the second time and prayed, saying, O my Father, if this cup may not pass away from me, except I drink it, thy will be done. And he came and found them asleep again, for their eyes were heavy. And he left them, and he went away again, and he prayed a third time, saying the same words. Can you imagine the feeling that he would have had? That would certainly have been a feeling of loneliness. You bring your closest friends with you, because he knew, and he told them in the past what was happening, and they didn't get it all along. But he knew exactly to the detail what was happening, what was going to happen, what he had to go through. And he just asked Peter, James, and John to go a little further with him and stay awake. Stay awake with me, you know, and watch with me while I pray. They couldn't do it. They couldn't do it. I'm sure Christ still loved them. And I'm sure Christ still forgave them. But it didn't change what's about to happen. Judas leads a detachment of soldiers. Remember, he left just a few hours ago. Now he's back with a detachment of soldiers. They enter the garden. Judas presents the kiss of death, so to speak. And in the skirmish, Christ prevents Peter from fighting after he cuts off the ear of Malchus. And he allows himself to be bound and go with the mob. I call it a mob. It's a group, but they were not acting as just, you know, lawful just people. We move to early Wednesday morning. We have the high priest and Caiaphas. Christ is struck. He is spit upon and condemned for blasphemy because he spoke the truth. Of all things, he spoke the truth. He spoke the truth of being the Son of God. That's Mark 14, verse 53 through 65. I'm not going to read it. You can write it down. Meanwhile, in the courtyard, Peter, the one who said, I will go with you, I will die with you, I will be there for you, denies knowing Jesus Christ not once, not twice, but three times. Denies knowing three times. The rooster crows, and Jesus Christ looks directly into Peter's eyes. A moment of stinging truth. Peter realized what he had done. Luke 22, verse 54 through 62. Then the Sanhedrins send Christ to Pontius Pilate. Pilate sends him to Herod. Herod mocks him, puts him in a royal robe, then sends him back to Pilate. Luke 23, verse 1 through 12. And to satisfy the mob, Pilate has Jesus whipped with a Roman flagrum. Soldiers then press a crown of thorns into his scalp, and then they beat him with a staff. John 19, verse 1 through 3. Wednesday morning, the crucifixion, at 9 o'clock, Jesus is led towards Golgotha, weakened by blood loss. He stumbles. Simon of Cyrene is forced to carry the crossbeam. That's Mark 15, verse 21. Then we reach 9 o'clock, the third hour. The third hour, Jesus Christ is nailed to the cross. And it's amazing. After all this, he's nailed to the cross. He's raised up. And I want you to look in Luke 23, verse 34. His first words from the cross. Luke 23, verse 34. After all this, after all he'd been through, verse 34, then Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. Can you imagine? Wednesday afternoon, noon to 3 p.m. From noon to 3, darkness covered the land. The sun is obscured as Jesus Christ, the Lamb, bears the weight of the world's sins. That's Matthew chapter 27 and verse 45. I'll just read that to you. It says, now from the sixth hour to the ninth hour, there was darkness over all the land. And then we'd reach the ninth hour, 3 p.m. Jesus Christ cries out, it is finished. We read this last week, John 19, verse 30. This, again, as we said then, was a victory cry. He was confirming that the work that he had came to do was complete. And then he voluntarily yields up his life. At that moment, the moment of his death, there's a massive earthquake. It occurs. Rocks split, and the heavy temple veil is torn from top to bottom. That's Matthew 27, verse 51. Then we would reach Wednesday evening from 4 p.m. to 6 p.m. The soldier pierces Jesus' side with a spear to ensure death. He was already dead. Blood and water flow out, signifying a ruptured heart. John 19, verse 34. Then Joseph of Arimathea, something like that, and Nicodemus, who was kind of a secret follower, they very courageously went and asked for the body of Jesus Christ. They wrap him in linen and spices, and they place him in a brand new tomb before the sun sets. Sunset would begin a high Sabbath, the first day of unleavened bread, John 19, verse 38 through 42. Just as a note, sunset in that area on that day in 31 A.D. was approximately 5:55 p.m. So all the timing matches. Brother, this wraps up the last 24 hours of Christ's physical life here on earth. And what a great example that was for all of us. And I know typically we read this once a year, we go through this once a year, but I hope that we get everything out of it we possibly can. We should read it more than once a year, and I'm sure a lot of us do. But while most of us, you know, when we're faced with our final 24 hours, had we had the opportunity to know that, would instinctively reach out for the comfort of family. Maybe the beauty of nature, as we've seen in the surveys, or even some other thing on our bucket list. Jesus Christ, he redefined the finish line, if you will. The profound encouragement here is that Jesus served from a place of absolute security. He knew exactly who he was, where he came from, and where he was going. And brother, you and I have that same security. It's up to us if we choose not to accept it. But God has offered that to us. Because he was secure in the Father's love, you and I are too, he could extend grace even to Judas at his table. You and I have the opportunity to extend grace to all of our enemies if we choose. He proved that true greatness isn't found in the power that we hold, but it is in the people that we're willing to serve. It includes those who may never, ever, in our opinion, deserve that grace, or maybe never, ever repay us for a debt. That doesn't matter. Living like it's our last day, brethren, does not mean that we have to perform a miracle. it means that we have to be willing to pick up a towel. Whether it's doing the dishes, listening to a friend, or even praying for an enemy, we are like most Christ when we focus on how we can give, and certainly not on how or what we can get. So as we approach Passover, we're just a couple of days away from it now. Well, I hope and pray that we take these lessons, especially what we've learned from the last 24 hours of Christ's life, and let's rehearse them in our minds. Anything that we have questions about, take it to God. Allow God to give us the answers. Let's take this as we number our days, so to speak, and we're told to do that. Let us remember that the most world-changing work that you and I can do is the hidden work of a servant's heart. Brethren, let's have that heart as we go into Passover and Days of Unleavened Bread.